It's the Steve Fast Show on WJBC. Songwriter and actress Linda Thompson has no shortage of stories. She was a guest star on 70 shows like Chips and Starsky and Hutch. She was a regular on Hee Haw, and she was Miss Tennessee Universe. On top of that, she won an Emmy for her songwriting. But many of the stories she tells in her book, A Little Thing Called Life, revolve around her relationships with Elvis Presley, Bruce Jenner, and songwriter David Foster. She opens up about all of those in this memoir. We welcome Linda Thompson to the program now. Linda, thanks for being with us today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So let's cut right to, I guess, the first big romantic story in your book. When did you first meet Elvis?
Oh, gosh, July 6th, 1972, to be exact, around midnight. So I guess technically that would be July 7th. But I met him at the Memphian Theater. He used to rent out the movie theater and show usually double features because back then we only had four stations and TV went off by midnight. And so to entertain himself, he would rent out the Memphian Theater. And I was invited by a mutual friend of ours to come to the theater and to meet Elvis and to see the film.
Do you remember what movies he wanted to see?
Oh, not even close. That's been a running joke for many years that neither Elvis nor I remembered what movies he was screening that night because we were so sort of entrenched in each other's attention. You know, it was very funny because once I discovered that he was not married anymore and, you know, he was hitting on me and I was very standoffish. And finally he said, honey, you know, I'm not married anymore. So then, you know, we started talking and, you know, through two features, got to know each other pretty well sitting there in the theater since he rented it out and he could talk as loudly as he wanted. And neither of us remembered at the time, and nor do I now, what movie he was showing that night. It was two features. So I have no idea. Probably something to do with karate.
That just seems so appropriate.
I know.
You mentioned that it was around midnight, and that was kind of a little bit of the type of hours that Elvis kept. What was it like to get into that world, to be part of Elvis's world? Because he sort of did have to separate himself from what we would consider everyday normal life.
Absolutely. It's a good observation that, you know, his day kind of began when the sun went down. He was very nocturnal. And, you know, really, we lived our lives after the sun went down. You know, we lived like vampires, we used to joke. And after a while, I have to be honest, it got to be a little depressing because, you know, there is that seasonal disorder, depression that people suffer from. And living your life and primarily in darkness was depressing. So it was a very interesting lifestyle that we did live. And after a while, it got to be a little oppressive and depressive.
Do you think that that affected Elvis as well? The not spending a lot of time in the daylight?
Yeah. I think it probably did without his being cognizant of it or my being aware of it either at the time. But I think it must have, you know. I just think that that's a very real thing, that we all need light and sunshine. And, you know, we had moments of it. We would, in Las Vegas, you know, we would wake up and go outside and lie in the sun and, you know, soak up some sun. So we did have, you know, times that we would spend in the sun. But for the most part, you know, our lives were lived in darkness. And I think I think it must have had an impact on his mood.
Well, I guess he really did like to surround himself in his isolated world with people that brought him joy and he could become, comfortable with. And you shared a common sense of humor with him. You're right about that.
Oh, yeah, we really did. You know, we grew up very much the same way with the same kind of family and same sort of familial ties, you know, and religious fervor and the same love of all things Southern. And we both loved Monty Python. He introduced me to Monty Python. We both loved Hee Haw, you know, just kind of inane, nonsensical humor. And we both loved to tease each other and joke around. So we did. That was one of the many bonds that we had, and that was our kind of kindred sense of humor as well as our kindred spirits.
Well, Elvis definitely was sort of the alpha male amongst his group, his posse, and his world. And so it's interesting to see that you write that Elvis had insecurities and he kind of went through a bit of a midlife crisis. You detail that a bit.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because I think it's so important to point out, too, that we are all human. And that takes nothing away from the greatness of anyone or their accomplishments or their contributions to the world. It simply connects them, you know, those, you know, idealized few, it connects them to the rest of humanity. So he was no different from anyone else in that he had insecurities, and, you know, he would go through the same antics that all of us do, and we think we're getting older and, you know, losing your looks or whatever. So he kind of went through that. And he, you know, he was a very shy and humble man at the very core of his being. So I think it's nice to understand, and it's important for people to understand that, you know, we have a tendency to put celebrities on a pedestal and not allow for them to be human. And it's a disservice to the person who is famous, you know, to be isolated like that. They're isolated enough by their fame. So, you know, you need friends to surround you and people who love you to just be very real with you. And, you know, certainly Elvis and I shared that kind of relationship where we were honest with each other to the extent that we could be, given some of the things that we went through.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking with Linda Thompson. She's written a memoir called A Little Thing Called Life. And in that memoir, she talks not only about her career as an actress and songwriter, but three relationships in particular, big ones in her life, one with Elvis, which we've been talking about. And also, she was married to Bruce Jenner and songwriter David Foster. You mentioned that you watched Hee Haw with Elvis, and of course, you were on Hee Haw. And I wonder, as a songwriter, you know, being on that show and being on that set and seeing, you know, accomplished songwriters like Buck Owens goofing around and seeing the musical guests come through because the cast would always be around for the tapings. Did that have an influence on your aspirations to write songs?
It absolutely had an influence on my creative impulse. You know, I was so inspired by all the country music artists who came through there. Such great storytellers. The country music writers. So it definitely had an influence on my, you know, artistic endeavor. In fact, the first song that I had covered was by Kenny Rogers. So it was really a wonderful experience to be on that show for 15 years. And throughout the book, I put lyrics between each chapter. And I think it's interesting to go back and kind of observe how occurrences in my life, experiences in my life, help to co-write the lyrics of some of my songs. You know, you are inspired by all of the circumstances in your life, all the occurrences and the experiences that you have. So Hee Haw really did help to color and shape my songwriting craft, for sure.
Well, the songwriting did take you to some interesting places. And I wonder, what's it like to write a song with Clint Eastwood? A lot of people don't know he's a musician and has his own record label. A lot of people do because he's a big jazz fan, and of course he's involved in a lot of the music in his films. But you wrote a song or co-wrote a song for one of his movies.
Yes, for True Crime, and the song was recorded by Diana Krall. It's called Why Should I Care? And, you know, I think he's a highly underrated songwriter. He's just got the most beautiful melodies emanate from within him. I mean, he's just an incredible artist, you know, and on so many levels. But yeah, that was kind of trippy to be able to say. Even today, I always kind of glow a little when I say, yes, Clint Eastwood wrote that music. And Carol Bayer Sager and I actually wrote the lyric together. But he's quite remarkable and such a gentleman. You know, he's always very complimentary. You know, oh, my favorite lyricist when I see him. So, you know, he's just a true gentleman.
So what is your favorite collaboration of all the songs you've worked on?
Oh, that's an interesting question. Never been asked that one, actually. But I would have to say one of my very most favorite collaborations was with Steve Dorff. Steve and I wrote a song that I wrote in honor of my sons called Miracle, Who Could Ever Love You More? And probably that's the most meaningful song to my heart, you know, and definitely demonstrates the unconditional love that a parent feels for their child. And Celine Dion recorded that when she had her son, Renee Charles. So I would have to say that's the most sentimentally, you know, important song that I wrote and most important collaboration in that regard. Obviously, I have nothing from The Bodyguard, which David wrote the music for, David Foster wrote the music for, and I wrote the lyric, was the most successful song that I have ever been, you know, involved in.
So you mentioned your sons and writing the song for your sons, Brandon and Brody. That brings us to a big part of your book, which is your marriage to Bruce Jenner. And mm-hmm. I think with your former husband coming out as transgender, you probably have a lot of people ask you questions. And I'm sure they did before your book came out. And you're very candid about that life in your book. And you write in the book about Bruce Jenner confessing to you while you were married that he had gender dysphoria. How long in the marriage did he come forth to tell you this?
Well, I write about it in detail in the book that we had been married. We'd been together probably about 6 years. I had already had 2 sons with him. There was absolutely no indication that there was anything other than, you know, masculine instincts, you know, coursing through Bruce Jenner. And people ask me that, well, were there any signs? Were anything going on there? You, looking back, can you, you know, kind of discern now, oh, that makes sense? No, absolutely nothing. This was all man. This Bruce Jenner was just, you know, the most masculine of men. I had never met anyone that masculine, that athletic, you know, and that seemingly comfortable in his own skin. So for him to come to me when Brody was 18 months old and Brandon was 3 and a half, and tell me that he was wanted to transition, that he was transgender, that he identified as female, was beyond shocking. You know, it was devastating. And we immediately went into therapy. I did keep his secret for 30 years, you know, until she emerged, until Caitlin came out on the Diane Sawyer special. And, you know, that kind of freed me up to finish writing my memoir, because I had started writing it about 11 years ago, but I had to put it away. I was about, you know, an introduction and 4 chapters in, and then thought to myself, I would never betray that confidence. And, you know, I kept Bruce's secret for all those years, and I had to wait until Caitlin emerged. And then, you know, I was free to write about my life. And there have been so many stories along the way, so much misinformation, and, you know, about me as well as other people in my universe, you know. So I felt it was finally time to tell my own life story from my perspective and not someone else's. I think it's important that, you know, Caitlin tells her story from her perspective. I tell mine. You know, we're all kind of in this together. and, you know, it's important also, I think, to point out to everyone, I know it's a very difficult thing to understand, but I don't think that we necessarily need to understand someone's plight or someone's life in order to accept it. You know, I think it's important for us to just be kind, and if you can't help someone, at least don't hurt them in their journey.
I think it's a tough thing for people to understand now, but at the time, this was the mid-80s. Was it about 1985 that he came forth? So in 1985, the social environment was very different than now. How long, even with therapy, did it take you to wrap your head around your husband's declaration that he was transgender and the entire concept of gender dysphoria?
We went to therapy for 6 months, and during the course of that therapy, it was pointed out to me very pointedly by our therapist that this is absolutely who Bruce was, and that he was not going to change. This is something that he wanted to do. He wanted to transition. And even if he stopped the transition, which he did, and 5 years into it, that this would never go away. This was really part and parcel, you know, of who he was. So he did begin the transition. And I said back then, you know, I waived child support and alimony. I said, look, I'm here for you. I'm your friend, but I didn't bargain to be married to a woman. So I divorced him, but we remained very good friends for a very long time. And after 5 years of going through therapy, I mean, hormone therapy for him, and having feminizing surgeries and that kind of thing, he decided that, as you so succinctly pointed out, you know, in 1985, the world was even less prepared for, you know, for transgenders than they are now. So imagine now it's difficult for people to wrap their heads around it. And, you know, it's not like it was just John Doe either. It's easy enough, you know, when you have any signs and any kind of signs along the way that someone might have an issue. But with Bruce Jenner, it was like, you know, it's just the manliest of men. So it was, I think it's just been very shocking for the world. But she's great about it. Caitlin, you know, understands that it's difficult to kind of transpose the he to she now, and, you know, we get mixed up on our pronouns, and but she's very understanding and, you know, has a sense of humor about it, and it seems to be just so much happier now than she was for so many years trying to repress who she felt she was.
You know, you talk about how it was a confusing time for both of you, and it seemed like Bruce at the time, while trying to transition into Caitlin early on in the 80s, kind of really didn't know how to handle it. And there were a couple of things that you write about in the book that are just very, I think that the timing might not have been right. He had an idea of maybe even how to handle the kids, your two children. And there was even an idea that he thought he was going to reintroduce himself to them after gender reassignment.
Well, he was struggling. Yes. You know, he was definitely struggling and reaching for any lifeline back then. And, you know, it's understandable, again, that when someone has struggled for their whole lives with this, this is something that had been with Bruce since he was of cognizant memory, you know, 3 or 4 years old. He would look in the mirror and realize that nature had dealt him an unkind blow in his estimation. So even though he was the perfect epitome of a man, that's the irony, you know, we never know what's going on inside another person. There's so many lessons I feel in the book and in, you know, in having lived my life, I'm astonished by my own life. To be honest, you know, going back and sort of excavating all my old memories and feelings and trying to feel them deeply enough to articulate them effectively enough so that the reader understands. It's just, it's a fascinating, fascinating life, even for me. You know, I'm astounded at some of the things that have transpired in my life. But I think it's important to derive some lessons, you know, from the read. And one of them is that we never know what's going on inside another person. So, you know, it is incumbent upon us to just be kind to each other. And again, if you can't help someone, at least don't hurt them in their journey in life, because you just can't look at someone and tell what's kind of turmoil is happening inside them and what they might be struggling with.
You know, you mentioned that you never really know what's going on inside somebody's personal life. And having been involved with three very high-profile relationships, you talked about your husband, Bruce Jenner. You talked about your other husband, David Foster. And then, of course, Elvis Presley. I don't think there's anyone more famous. That has to be a strange thing to grasp with, even when you're not in the relationship anymore, to deal with the fact that these are public figures. You see things going on in their life. You saw the transition sort of hinted at and happen with Bruce transitioning into Caitlin in a very public way. What's it like to sort of be in that position, even if you're not actively in the relationship?
Yeah, it's interesting because my choice in life is to live a lot more, you know, behind the scenes. I'm not one that seeks out the spotlight. I'm not an attention seeker. I'm perfectly happy living in Malibu under a rock, as I often joke. I make jam every summer. I make apricot and plum jam. I rescue animals. I have chickens. I have rose gardens. So I'm, you know, I'm so content to live under the radar. So it is kind of interesting for me to observe some of the choices that at least two of my exes, you know, have made. David was on The Real Housewives of Beverly Hills, which is a very public, you know, sort of display of your life. And then Bruce was on The Kardashians, which is, again, you know, a big public display. And then transitioning was very public. So it's been interesting, you know, to observe from the sideline, but I'm way on the sideline. You know, I'm not a part of the fray. I wish everyone well, but I'm definitely not a part of that. It's been kind of against every fiber of my being to put myself out there, write my life story, and then have to go out and, you know, and promote it, because it's not really representative of who I am. You know, I'm much quieter and more retiring than that, and happy to be in the shadows.
Well, Linda Thompson, thank you for stepping out of the shadows for a little bit to talk to us and to talk about this memoir. It's called A Little Thing Called Life. We've been talking with Linda Thompson about her book, and we'd like to thank her for being with us on the show. Linda, thanks for joining
us today.
Thank
you. I'm very excited. You know, the book hit the New York Times bestselling list in the first week. So that's very exciting.
A pretty big splash right off the bat.
Yeah, I would say. I may have to give up making jam and just get out there and write some more books. Or
well, it's maybe a little more lucrative. I haven't tried the jam, but maybe.
It's pretty good.
Linda Thompson joining us today on the show. Thanks, Linda.
Thank you so much, Steve.